Well, good morning and a happy Thursday, and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Sure appreciate your tuning in and being at the other end of the radio waves and the telephone lines and all the multiple ways we have of communicating with one another nowadays, because you are always welcome and invited to be part of the conversation. Telephone 414-1234 local. It's 800-926-8809 long distance, because we do stream on the web, and sometimes we get in calls from places like North Carolina or Washington State or the wilds of Osceola. Who knows? Could come from anywhere. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address, and we accept tweets at WFSU Perspective. Well, if you ever watch the History Channel, which I do, full disclosure, you might be familiar with intriguing theories on where our ancestors came from and how they got here. Now, some of these concepts, as you may know, involve everything from ancient space aliens to the Knights Templar. But just east of Tallahassee, True Scientific Inquiry is uncovering some evidence that's really every bit as fascinating and a lot more verifiable than some of the stuff you see on the tube. This morning on Perspectives, we'll talk about that as a run-up to next month's First Floridians, First Americans Conference at the Monticello Opera House. That's coming up October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And so we say hi to some of the folks working behind the scenes to bring that event to fruition. First of all, our good friend, no stranger to these microphones, Ann Holt, who is conference coordinator and head of Main Street Monticello. And it's good to see you, Ann. And thanks for bringing these folks out today.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, everything okay in Monticello?
Everything's okay. People are signing up for the conference. I've completed a program. I just think it's going to be a tremendous conference, maybe even bigger and better than the one in 2012.
That's right. Yeah, that was the kickoff. That was the very, very first one.
That was the first one. We're already talking about the third one.
Well, let's get the second one out of the way first. That's what we'll talk about here today. One of the maestros in the educational field when it comes to all this stuff is Jack Carswell, associated with the Osceola Research Institute. And I envision, Jack, this huge, it looks like the headquarters of Sony Corporation or something, with all these white-coated scientists and archaeologists running around. Is that what the institute looks like?
Well, then, it certainly does in my mind. And we've been able to call that image forward in other people's minds. So we hope we're headed in that direction.
Okay, but you've done an awful lot of field trips out to the dig site and all that kind of thing. So
absolutely. The fascinating part of this, it seems to me, I own a company in California, and we have a lot of young people that we hire. And one of the things we say to them, that life's full of a lot of journeys. And one journey that you have to pay attention to that is among the most rewarding journey in life is your intellectual journey. Your educational journey is not over when you get out of college or stuff. And this event is a free event. You can go to Monticello for, 4 days? And here's some of the most important scientists in the United States and in Canada talk about the sort of on the cusp what's happening in archaeology. And I think that's pretty fascinating. And it doesn't cost you any money. You can come there and sit for 4 solid days and hear important people talk.
Well, boy, you cannot beat the price of admission there, Jack, but also the quality of the research and all that. That brings us around here to the other end of the table, and Dr. James Dunbar, one of the early investigators of the Page Ladson dig site. And Dr. Jim, tell us how this whole thing got started, because we do not think traditionally in this country that some of the very first North American ancestors we have were North Floridian. What happened to lead you to this conclusion that this might, in fact, be true?
Well, we started the operations in 1983. And one of the reasons we did, a river diver by the name of Don Serbosic had noticed some odd things on that river bottom. And he thought that they would be scientifically important. So in 1983, we came out to do underwater prehistoric archaeology, and that hasn't been done very many places. And By 1987, we'd settled in on a site that we named the Page Ladson site. And we started finding a stratigraphic level that was buried like, you know, under 15 to 20 feet of sediment. And it had Pleistocene megafauna bones in it, like mastodon and bison and ancient paleo camel and things like that. And then we started finding artifacts, and we're to a degree saying, uh-oh, because they're too old. Or the thought at that time was that Clovis was first, and there wasn't anything older than Clovis, which Clovis is about 13,000 years old.
And that's out west, right?
And that's out west, but it's also in Florida. Clovis is this odd culture that sort of spans the entire country from one end to the other and goes down into Central America and now appears to show up in South America in some places. So it was a culture of – or maybe a tool tradition is a better way of putting it, where they had a certain way of making certain kinds of classes of tools that are very diagnostic. But anyway, here we were at the Page Ladson site, 30 feet below sea level in a sinkhole filled with sediment, and we start finding evidence that people and these big Pleistocene animals coexisted at that time. And so we held our gunpowder, so to speak. And by 1997, we had completed the dig. We had made some indication that we had a very old site, but between 97 and 2006, all the researchers got together, and it took that long to compile and get a book published on the findings we had at that one site alone. And I would say that it caused quite a stir. We had a site that was well older than Clovis, and by 1,500 years at least, and it had the artifacts in it. And some people that are in the profession accepted it, but others did not. So it came under fire, which is fair game. That's what happened in sciences. So in 2012, the Center for the First Americans, Mike Waters and Jesse Halligan came in to do a second opinion. And they worked there, I think – well, they were actually there this past year looking at the site. And they have confirmed the age and actually found at least one artifact that's a little bit more interesting than the artifacts we found when we were there. And they've pretty much confirmed the age at about 14,425 to 50 or something like that years old, which is well older than Clovis. And it just shows, well, people were here for a very long time. And there's one other site that we're looking at now that appears to have that same age component at Wakulla Springs. And so far we've just looked on land, but hopefully we'll be out in the water looking at yet another mastodon in 7 feet of water.
Yeah, okay, because obviously these people didn't just live in one area along the Ocilla River. Like Clovis, as you said, that was that's across the continent. And so this particular strata of folk, they had to be in a broader geographic area than just in Jefferson County, right?
Right. And what it maybe preliminarily looks like, and it needs to be demonstrated in the ground in a greater way, there's a projectile point complex they call the Miller complex that in places like Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania, Cactus Hill in Virginia, and Delmarva Peninsula in Chesapeake Bay, they're finding this point complex that looks similar to what we have down here, but it's actually older and they're smaller projectile points. And it, you might make an argument that that projectile point horizon morphed into what we found at Page Ladson at a later time, and that what found at Page Ladson morphed eventually into Clovis. But we're that's imperfect knowledge there. What we do know is we do have people here in Florida, in North Florida in particular, at that very early age. So we need to fill in the blanks. We need to find the next missing link, I guess.
Okay, and projectile points, you're talking like spears, arrowheads,
right,
that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what does this mean, Ann Holt, when we're talking about this area of North Florida now being a major archaeological dig site that's kind of turning a lot of our conventional wisdom on its head?
What it means is with the Osceola Research Institute, we can become a leader in this area, in finding this knowledge, because scholars will want to come here, and we'll be able to offer them support. We are fortunate to have 24 of the world's top scholars coming here the first week of October to talk to us. Dennis Stanford from the Smithsonian will speak on Thursday night. The title of his talk is Paleolithic Mariners, Paleo Indians in Boats, Watercraft of Some Kind. The idea is mesmerizing, and that these scholars would be willing to come here, none of them charging a fee. They're coming in Wednesday and stay until Sunday because this is important. It's truly important.
Well, it's also the term revolution gets thrown around with such great casualness nowadays, but it's certainly an evolutionary kind of thought as we look at the scientific progenesis of who our ancestors are, right, Doc?
Right, and I think one of the important things that, in my opinion, makes the Osceola River the crown jewel of future research is that there is a site in the Osceola River we haven't talked about yet. It's called the Latvis Simpson site. It has in it preserved round gourd seeds.
Well, let's find out how those gourds got there. We'll take a quick time out and then back and talk about the Latvis Simpson site on top of the Page Ladson dig site that's in the Osceola Basin as we talk about early Floridians and Americans here on Perspectives. Welcome back to Perspectives, and we're talking about ancestors and not great-grandpa and maybe going back 4, 5, 6, 10 generations. How about going back 14,000-plus years to some of the earliest people to settle in this part of the country who also were among the very first people to settle in the Americas? That's what we're talking about here with the First Floridians, First Americans Conference coming to the Monticello Opera House October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And with us, Ann Holt, Jack Carlswell, and Dr. James Dunbar, who are involved with the conference and giving us a little bit of a preview on that. And Dr. Jim, we were talking about the Latvis Simpson site, which is a second dig area there. And gourds, of what possible significance could gourds be?
We found them at the Page Ladson site, and they seem to have originated from the south end of a northbound mastodon. In other words, they were eating gourds. And we found that in, to be polite about it, the digesta of that animal that died there. And so we found another site. A fellow named Joe Latvis was diving in the bottom of a little river section of the Osceola and dove down into this sinkhole, and at about 30 feet below present somewhere about that time, depth, he stumbled on these two things that looked like tree stumps, and they were about maybe a foot and a half above the surface, and he got looking at them, and there were two tusks sticking out of the ground, where the bitter end of them had fallen off years ago. So they thought, well, this is another Page Ladson site. Well, turns out it wasn't. When they excavated it, they found a number of animals. The mastodon was the main thing. They found the gut tract contents of the mastodon, which had the Cucurbita pipo gourd seed, a small round gourd. And the date on that, to be conservative, is 36,000 years old. Now, we haven't found – well, I'll take that back. There's been one flint flake that may have come from there, but that's really – that's not a site yet, an archaeological site. But the wonderful thing about the Page-Latson site and the Lapis-Simpson site, and there are a dozen more that we have dated – if you look and envision that the Asilah River is a sinkhole that has come above the ground, flowed down, and gone underground, and you now swim down the bottom of one of these sections in the Asilah River, you'll find a number of sinkholes that are about 28 to 35 feet deep, and most of them are backfilled with sediment. Of the ones we've looked at, we have, I think the oldest one is right on the edge of radiocarbon dating technology. It's about 47,000 years old. And at the young end, we're getting right to the transition of the late Pleistocene into what is modern times, the Holocene, which occurs at about 10,000 radiocarbon years ago. In all of those sediment fills, there are finely preserved organic remains that provide a potential that has not really been tapped yet to understand exactly what the environment of Florida looked like when the big animals were there, maybe when water tables were up or down, and that type of information. So it really, the importance of this thing spans way beyond archaeology into paleoenvironmental issues, into the potential for being able to look at isotopes in these animals to understand if they were migrating and if they were migrating, where they migrated from and to. For example, the Page-Latson mastodon isotope work there, looking at the strontium isotopes, suggests that it was migrating between Atlanta, that had a granitic groundwater aquifer, and Florida, that has a karst or limestone aquifer. And it finally passed away at the Page-Latson site. And whether it was killed by people is still a question that is not answered, maybe. But it was at least butchered by people.
Well, we have then remains of animals like the mastodon. We have human artifacts like the spear points, the projectile points that have been found. Yeah. Any human remains amongst all of this?
Not yet. That's not saying it won't happen one day, but not yet. I think you have to look at these sinkhole sites as being a little bit in the way of maybe a hunting ground where the people would come in and do that activity and then back out and leave. They would take the animal's flesh and take it back to camp and smoke it or whatever they did to preserve the meat. But you don't want to necessarily camp in the same place that you're hunting. Mm-hmm. So that's another mystery to solve, I guess, is to try to identify a place where these early people actually camped, because their campsite is usually far more informative as far as the tool kits that these people had and maybe what they were using the tool kits for, and that type of thing. So, I mean, there's still a lot of great avenues of research to be done on these very early sites. And it now would appear that Florida, at least North Florida at least, and I suspect other parts of Florida, are the epicenter of some of these earliest occupations.
That is incredible. Now, I'm just thinking, though, Jack Carswell, what would happen if you came across, since all early people had some variation of this, an actual burial site? in this area, what that would mean for the research and pulling together some of these loose threads.
It would be extraordinary that the one fascinating deal to be involved with in this, and one of the reasons people should show up at this conference, because it is fascinating. And I failed all these courses in college myself. And so the Lord has given me a second chance hanging around these scholars.
Yeah, you've just retaken the course, that's all. Yeah.
So what, one of the interesting things when you think about it is Jim and his colleagues and the scholars in American science is extraordinary. They know, for example, by analyzing what they find in the remains of the Macedon, they know that the Macedon that died there, that his mother and father lived up around Atlanta. And they also know that his grandfather and grandmother live somewhere in Kentucky. So how they know these things is the most extraordinary thing. And I went with Rochelle Meredith to look at a site, and there were some. She had some musket balls. And Michelle, as a scholar, and the people that are experts in her discipline, can tell you if it was an English musket ball or if it was a Spanish musket ball. And the way it seemed extraordinary to me, so I asked her how you do that. Well, just what Jim just said, that the trace elements in the English musket ball are different than the trace elements in the Spanish musket ball. So, I mean, we have some pretty gifted scientists out there, and they deserve a lot of respect, and they're interesting people to hang around with.
Boy, I bet, and I was just thinking of the usefulness of, let's see, what do we call it, organic chemistry and all of that that plays into this as well, to analyze exactly what it is that you found and to help with the – to back up the carbon dating and the other techniques that are available to figure out how old this stuff actually is.
Yeah. When we first started at the Page Latson site and eventually uncovered this 9-foot-long tusk, and, you know, we had to dig down 5-10 feet to get to it and uncovered the thing. A decision had to be made after it was recovered is, what do we want to do with the tusk? Do we want to more or less leave it intact and have it for a nice museum display, or do we want to do science on it? And we opted to do the science, which is the people that do these things, they split the tusk down like a banana split and split it open. And an elephant's tusk grows throughout the elephant's lifetime. And there are annual growth rings in the ivory. And they went down and sampled them. And that's how they determined that the mammoth – or mastodon, I should say – you know, migrated between Atlanta and in Florida from a granitic to a limestone aquifer and eventually died down here. Also could show that mastodons were a browsing animal. In other words, they like shrubbery to eat, whereas a mammoth was a grazer animal. On a much further time depth, if you go back to the Miocene, 12 million years – not Miocene, I'm sorry, early Pleistocene, mammoths first come into the Americas at about 1.86 million years ago. And when that happens, in Florida at least, they weren't expecting this result. But using, you know, the isotopes and whatnot, what they found is that in all likelihood the mammoths came in and really altered the terrain in a way where it reduced the woodlands, opened up grasslands, made a larger area of grazing land, not only for them, but other grazing animals. And one of the camels started to be alter its way of making a living by being a mixed browser and a grassland grazer, which I think is fascinating. And then the mammoth die out. And we don't know exactly when that happens. And that's a big research question in my mind's eye. But if they die out, say, 15,000 years ago in Florida, it will put the other animals in stress because all of a sudden the grazing land that they had opened up will start closing back. And so there are those kind of things. And you get where you have elephants today in Africa, they create a short grass prairie. When you take the elephants out of that short grass prairie, it turns into a long grass prairie, and your likelihood of having a fire occurrences greatly increases, which incidentally we in Florida at least see some increase in fire frequencies in and around the time that maybe mammoths die out. But we really need to check that out and make sure it's true. These are the kind of research avenues people can go down if they have the right site that can actually answer it.
God, because you think traditionally, again, about the impact of the environment on the animals, but not vice versa. And right. And you're seeing that in play here.
I think so, really. I mean, I think there were possibly two keystone species in Florida. One was the mammoth, and the other doesn't seem like it would do too much, but the American beaver. Because it has the ability to come into a watershed and totally change the habitat. And in doing so, many more species come there because of the ponds the beavers make and that type of thing. While that hasn't been proven, I think that keystone species are important to pay attention to. And maybe when you get the right archaeological site, you can make some statement about that.
More fascinating stuff coming up during this conference. Scott's been waiting on line one very patiently and wants to join the conversation. Hey, Scott, welcome to Perspectives.
Hi.
Hey.
I didn't want to get completely off topic, but I actually live out there, kind of close to the Ocala River. And I've noticed that I've been out there since 08, and the Ocala is almost totally dry up until, like, where the boat ramp is. It needs landing. I don't know where you guys, if you know where I'm talking about.
Yes.
But I've also noticed, because usually out of my property, I can dig down about 3-4 feet, and I start hitting water. And once I saw the Ocala was dry, being as bored as I am, I went out and started digging. And I noticed water table's really low, but I've also heard rumors that they have the river blocked somewhere in Georgia. I was just wondering if you guys knew anything about that. Cause,
I wouldn't know anything about the river being dammed up in Georgia, actually, but I do know that we have gone through some fairly substantial droughts, particularly the one that sticks in my mind's eye is 2007-2008.
Yeah.
Where
I mean, it was still up then, you know.
But the actual the Ekenfina River at the US 98 bridge went bone dry.
Yeah.
At that time, and as far as I can tell, it's the only second time that it's ever happened.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know about. I haven't paid attention to where the dams are on the upper river. Go ahead.
I was just asking because I had heard you mention something about the Ocala River actually will go down into aquifers and then come back up later on. So,
right. Now, that's in a different area of the river. When you get up towards Sneed Smokehouse and you get up into Georgia –
uh-huh.
The water in that river is flowing over Miocene clay deposits that don't penetrate into the limestone. The Miocene clays are sort of preventing that from happening. And then finally, when you get far enough downriver, you come off the Cody Scarp, which is an escarpment of several, 50 or 60 feet. And you get down on the real coastal plain, which is about 25 feet above sea level or less, the limestone is occurring right at the surface, and that's where the river starts going under and back up and down and up and down.
Okay.
And it's a very erratic river channel, much of which is underground. It's not on the surface.
I think what Scott says, though, it calls to mind is something important. And one of the reasons that there's a lot of interest in the Ocala Research Center is some of the things that Jim and them are finding will enable us to construct a better history than we have. And that has to do with climate, how much rainfall there was, where the sea level was, all of that stuff. And I'm over my head a little bit, and Jim can help me. But when they pulled up a core that went back 40,000 years ago, you really can start at the bottom of that core and go year one, 40,000, year two, year three, and come forward. And there's information in there that the state of Florida needs, that our nation needs, that give us a sounder scientific base to make policy on. So this is a very important site for those kind of reasons.
Yeah, and the one thing that we want to talk about here, coming up rapidly on a break, and Scott, hope you can come out to the conference, because then you can learn something about your backyard river and what it was like maybe 14, 20, 30, 45,000 years ago. But we'll want to talk about exactly why did these animals and these early peoples wind up in North Florida? The lack of an income tax, or perhaps they just like the way that the environment was at that particular time. What drove them to this area much earlier than most scientists had thought they were here? We'll find that out and answer some more questions, too, when we continue our chat about the upcoming conference on Paleo-Indian Settlement of the Americas, taking place October 1, 2, and 3 in mighty Monticello, Florida, right here on Perspectives. Here's something. If you like National Geographic and you maybe have the one from January of this year, there's a mention in there. Hey, if you got to go run. Get it. Check this out. That the Page Lanson dig site in the Osceola River Basin near Tallahassee is one of only 10 sites for studying early human settlement in the Western Hemisphere. One of 10. And it's literally in our own backyard. And Dr. Jim Dunbar, you were talking about the 14,400 years old, at least. That's how long ago there were human settlements in this area. And again, where did these people come from, and why did they come here?
Well, I think one of the things that plays into that formula of why do people come here in the southeastern U.S., there were some odd environmental conditions that really I don't think anybody has a coherent explanation for it, because more research needs to be done. But if you just look at the animals that lived in the southeastern United States, there were species that we call neotropical. What that means, they come out of South America and Central America, and they came and migrated into Florida. There were species that would generally be in the desert southwest, and they migrated into Florida. And then we had the species that were here anyway. So if you could envision the southeastern United States, especially in Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, a little bit of Mississippi – that it had – that area had more species of animals and had more populations of those animals than any other place in North America. And the reason for that seems to be that there was some kind of a thermal enclave. In other words, it may have been cold during the glacial times in other latitudes and other parts of North America. But something about the Appalachian Mountains blocking maybe the cold flow of winter air conditions, it didn't happen in the southeast. So we had these thermally sensitive species, such as two species of giant land tortoise. They can't dig a hole in the ground and hide from the cold in the winter. they lived as far north as North Carolina. And you didn't have to go very far beyond North Carolina to start getting into really frigid weather, because in Virginia, we had the woolly mammoth. Below that line, we had the Columbian mammoth, which was the southern mammoth. So conditions were quite different in the southeast U.S. And, you know, if you could finally make your way from whatever direction you came in to get into the southeast, you probably thought you were in heaven because of the number of prey animals you had to pick on. Some that could run away from you very fast, and others that, like a giant tortoise, that was a cinch to catch that. So it was a very interesting biota. At the end of the Pleistocene, the extinction that occurred in the southeast was larger than any other extinction in North America because of the species richness it had, and it came to an abrupt end. But if you want to look at it this way, the Paleo-Indian hunters that morphed into early archaic hunters got off of Survivor Island, I guess, and survived all that trauma that saw all these species become extinct, or to use another word, some didn't become extinct, they just moved out of the area.
Okay, well, but from a sportsman's paradise, as the little sign says, as you head down 319 into Wakulla County, we had this mass extinction here. And what happened?
Actually, there may be an answer to that, but this is my hypothesis. It doesn't mean it actually happened. There was an event that took place beginning about 13,000 calendar years ago or shortly thereafter, where a massive amount of ice came rafting out into the North Atlantic Ocean. It had happened before, but this time it could only go into one part of the North Atlantic because the Gulf Stream had started flowing again and blocked that ice raft's ability to come towards European coastline. And believe it or not, in the southeastern United States, off of Charleston, South Carolina, in a place called Georgetown Hole, massive accumulations of icebergs took place for the first time ever in the history of the southeast U.S. because all the oceanographic data shows that the Gulf Stream maintained its temperature throughout. It's warm. But if you have a massive amount of icebergs that come into the South Carolina coast, I think you have a recipe that is going to certainly nail the animals like the giant land tortoise. But that's imperfect knowledge. That's another area of research that we could know a little bit more about. But I think these are the kind of questions that are to the future to be answered. But it's just who would have thought in the southeastern United States we had icebergs from an ice rafting event.
Okay. Well, speaking of rafting, Ann Holt, you had mentioned something earlier in the program about paleo-mariners, or early peoples actually getting in that you can't even dignify them by calling them boats. They really were, I guess, rafts, animal skins, that kind of thing. Maybe coming from Europe over here?
Maybe coming from Europe. Maybe coming from the Basque area of southern France and northern Spain. We will hear from scientists who hypothesize that this actually may have happened. They may have come across open water. Their boats may have been more like ships than we think. There have been modern mariners that have proven that their ship or boat could go a long, long ways across an ocean. And we may find that we have shortchanged their abilities. Part of the reason for believing this is the ocean current understandings that we're coming to. Another part is the change in the configuration of coastlines over time. And another one is where the ice was. Jim mentioned that it came down to the Chesapeake at one time. They could have come in boats, and that is what Dennis Stanford will talk about. Mike Waters from Texas A&M talks about the possibility that some of the lithics or stone tools that we've found match some of the stone tools in Europe, and that it's hard to question that this art is the same as the art of the people over in Europe. How did it get here if they didn't come across the Atlantic?
Sure, because that rewrites our assumption again that, as we were taught, that you had the land bridge across the Bering Strait. These were Asiatic peoples who came down through Canada into the Northwest and then spread out. The Clovis folks, I guess, who then populated the country coming from the West. And you're saying there's a possibility that at least some came from the East.
Yes, I heard Michael Waters say these people may have come from the Basque area of France and Spain. I heard him actually say that in his talk. I think it's fascinating. And I hope people understand that I keep telling them, you have to talk to Ann Holt. I am not an archaeologist. I'm not a scientist. I'm a historian. Talk to me so I can understand you, and then everyone else can.
Well, and that'll be – if you're just joining us, we're talking about what's coming up at the Monticello Opera House October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. It is free. How many world-class scientific events of this caliber can you attend at absolutely no charge whatsoever? But we need to find out more in advance, so how do we go about doing that, Anne?
We have a website where you can register. It's www.firstfloridiansconference.com.
All one word, firstfloridiansconference.com.
Right. And if you have trouble at first, go back and make sure you put the S on Floridians.
That can make all the difference. I'm thinking almost, gosh, Jack Carswell, an economic development component of this whole thing, too. If you get lots of world-class scientists, archaeologists, and anthropologists, and people who are into chemistry and even physics, because now that's a part of archaeology, from what I understand, who are settling in this area or at least spending some time here, that has some repercussions, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does. I think that one of our hopes is to build an institute, a research institute that is devoted to the natural sciences, and to build it in Jefferson County. And our hope for that is that it will be an economic engine for Jefferson County. When I moved back home to Jefferson County, I spent most of my adult life in out west, and my professional life. I was stunned by the fact that we have a county that you can still drink out of our streams, that we have a county where the air is pristine and clean. Our wildlife in Jefferson County is way more diverse and better balanced than it was when I grew up there. It's fascinating. The ecological shape of Jefferson County is extraordinary in America these days. So one of the things that I was interested in is how do you keep that? And it came to with Ann and Jim and a lot of other people, scientists from Florida State. One of the things we talked about is if you can develop an academic institution in Jefferson County, it can be an economic driver, and it has a very soft ecological footprint, and it attracts a kind of attracts people and a kind of culture that enhances the quality of life and preserves something that and this is kind of true all over North Florida. There's something fabulous and something special You have to have spent most of your life somewhere else to really recognize it. My brother, who's lived here the whole time, he said, well, that's special to you, Jack, but it's not special to me. I'm tired of looking at it. I said, well, so we're excited about that possibility. The thing, other thing I'd say is if you want to experience some of this, you not only can come to the conference, but if you go on 27 and you go east from Tallahassee and you turn south in Jefferson County, you will come to an extraordinary landscape. And that Jim's been talking about and Ann's been talking about, and you can drive most of it, and it's it has a wonderful primeval look, and it's a wilderness that you have access to. You could do it on a Sunday afternoon, and the things we're talking about, you can get a sense of by just driving that area.
Well, considering some of the other dig sites that there are scattered around the world, whether it's in the primeval rainforests of South America or in the Himalayas, or I mean, this is a pretty decent dig site as far as having amenities close by, if not right on site. Right, Dr. Jim?
Yes, it really is. If I could give a little bit of a plug for a project I've just been working on, which is down at Wakulla Springs State Park. We have a cooperation of the Acela Research Institute, the Panhandle Archaeology Society at Tallahassee, or PAST, and the Friends of Wakulla. And all three of those organizations are 501(c), not-for-profit. And the Friends of Wakulla have funded the land dig we just finished to try to identify and hone in on where another one of these early sites may exist. And we have some very good leads. It's premature to say that we actually have it. We were doing post-hole digger holes. But it's a really interesting area, and I think that there are a number of scientists that are attracted to this area and that have been coming in already. And I hope that in the future this kind of research potential can be expanded with the right teams of people and researchers to do it.
Well, who knows where the next critical dig site is going to be? Again, these folks right. were not just in small pocketed areas. Right. They were spread out. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, your big challenge down there, it must be trying to keep Wakulla County historian Madeline Carr, from taking a permanent residence right there at the dig site. Because knowing her, this is one of the things that would just absolutely inflame her curiosity.
She's my co-conspirator down there on the Wakulla project.
She has truly offered leadership and been a tremendous help there. I'd like to say something about the conference and preparing for it. It takes about a year to put this conference together, and it takes a lot of people's support. We'll probably have 30 or 40 volunteers on site during the conference. It is financed by small grants, sponsorships by companies that want to be involved, and the attendees make donations. I'm always gratified and amazed. Some people, a guy from Massachusetts called and said, I want to come to this conference, and I can't find out how much you charge. And I asked for a donation, and he asked me if this astronomical sum was enough. And I told him that it was embarrassing. It was almost too much. But we really appreciate the support.
Well, this type of thing is worthy of the entire community support for all the reasons we've enumerated here today. And just the fact that history is being made, actually history is being uncovered just so close to home, and the research that we're going to hear about at the upcoming conference is just going to be incomparable. Ann Holt, thank you again for bringing these fine folks in and talking about what is something that normally you have to go thousands of miles to experience, but we're going to have it right over at the Opera House here in a couple weeks.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. James Dunbar, always good to see you, sir, and good luck with the digs.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And, of course, Jack Carswell. Thanks for coming in, Jack.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see you at the conference coming up October 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the Opera House. Well, a reminder, you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org, and we thank Taylor Cox, and we also thank Lydell Rawls for all the help that they give us here. We're going to be talking about Tallahassee's most unique theatrical companies, Young Actors Theater, next week right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.